From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston. Protests continued in the region last night over police brutality against black people in America. We talk with four people who were there in Brockton and Boston. We ask Suffolk County Sheriff Stephen Tompkins about how law enforcement is responding to this moment.
We as a nation must come to grips with the fact that the fabric of this nation is shredded and it is coming apart at the seams.
And we get historical perspective on race and policing. What are the open questions for you? Call us at 1-800-423-8255. Next on WBUR's Radio Boston. The latest now, Minnesota's Attorney General plans to increase charges against former Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin to second-degree murder in George Floyd's killing. AG Keith Ellison said he will also charge the other three officers involved. He's expected to provide an update this afternoon. Floyd was killed last week while being arrested by Minneapolis police. The charges come after another night of demonstrations in Boston and around the country, protesting police brutality and honoring Floyd's memory. Boston protests last night were tense at times, but remained peaceful. Just south of the city, after several hours of peaceful protesting in Brockton, a second wave of demonstrations escalated, including clashes with police.
Don't shoot! Don't shoot! Don't shoot!
This is the Brockton Enterprise, broadcasting live from downtown Brockton. We don't have much time, much juice in the batteries, but the police have moved forward on the protesters, shooting gas canisters. Protesters have been throwing fireworks at the cops and bottles. It's getting a little tense in downtown Brockton.
Sounds from last night, and we want to invite you to join the conversation. Did you go out yesterday to protest? What did you see? And what open questions do you have today? Call us. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Let's begin now in Brockton. The Boston Globe's Hiawatha Bray, a regular here on Radio Boston, was recording the scene on his phone and ended up getting pepper sprayed by police. He joins us now. Hiawatha, how are you today?
Oh, doing fine. But you got to stay away from that pepper spray. That stuff, wow, it's lively.
Yeah, I imagine. So what happened to you last night?
Well, not that much. I don't want to exaggerate it. I definitely got hit by pepper spray. But it was part of the attempt by the police to seize complete control of the street and push people off of it at a time when people were throwing firecrackers, water bottles, all kinds of debris at the police. I don't want to exaggerate that either. It wasn't large numbers of people doing that. But there were some people who consistently were throwing projectiles at the police, and the police had this apparently very well-thought-out plan. They had this huge bunch of people behind barricades, and at regular intervals, they would march the barricades forward and keep pushing people back towards Center Street and then under the bridge that goes under commuter rail and back toward, I forget the name of the street. But in any case, they were pushing us away and in the general direction of the Dunkin' Donuts. And as they were pushing people, they were urging people to go back, and I didn't have any kind of press credentials hanging off my shirt. Believe me, I have it hanging off now. But they just were spraying people with pepper spray to get them to move, and I was one of the people who got sprayed. And I suppose I could
get... So were you there... Were you there as a private citizen last night, just observing?
Oh, no,
you
I was there to help with coverage for the Globe, and I was just feeding them stuff that ended up in some of the stories today. I mean, that's what you do when you're, you know, the fire bell rings. You just jump up and you go. And it was, you know, just something I unhesitatingly did because I'm a journalist. It's what we do. And I don't want to lose sight of the fact, I mean, it was really fascinating. If you talk to protesters, if you talk to other journalists, everyone there agreed that this was not a case of the police being abusive or unnecessarily aggressive. This was a case of the police just simply saying, we are in control here. You will do things our way. You know, Donald Trump got in a lot of trouble for talking about they need to dominate, and I can understand why, but there's a sense in which that's absolutely the way you have to go with a large group of people, some of whom are rowdy. You have to send this message.
So let's,
there are a lot more of us.
Let's pause
we
there.
We are in control here. Do it our way. And I think that's the way they did. The cops, I never saw any cop losing his temper. I never saw him flailing away at people, shrieking at people. They just said, move, back, 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 and kept moving people back. They were very disciplined.
Hiawatha, earlier the protests were peaceful. This was a different wave of demonstration.
Yeah.
Okay, so you were not there for the protests at the middle school that
were peaceful. No, I was not. I was working on something else. I have other things to do. I was only out last night when I heard that things really went pear-shaped in the general area of the police station. Everything I've read from what happened, and I've talked to the mayor, I've talked to other people, this just was not happening earlier in the day. Everybody is absolutely, including other protesters. I talked to a person who was at the high school and at the middle school, and he said everything was just wonderful. It was so peaceful. It was orderly. So, the mayor was there. The police were taking a knee. Everything was great. It was at night that everything brewed up.
Why do you think that happened, Hiawatha?
Because it's dark and people think they can get away with stuff. There were people who were just obviously angry. There were other people who were obviously having fun. And come on, let's face it. A huge amount of this is indeed the COVID backlash. People are sick of being locked in their houses. I think a lot of this was just people having an excuse to go out and act rowdy. I really do. I mean, the people who were there as serious political protesters were certainly there, and they were there throughout the day, absolutely. But I think some of the trouble probably came from people who just wanted to blow off steam.
Okay, so last question for you, Hiawatha. You do live in Brockton.
Yeah.
Looking back yesterday, how are you feeling as a resident of the city?
Actually, on the whole, I'm rather pleased and rather proud because of the behavior, I think, of our city officials. I think they handled it really well. I mean, there just was not any kind of excessive, abusive behavior on the part of anyone in charge. In addition, I think that the troublemakers that we saw made up a very small fragment of the people you saw there. Most people, even the ones who are angry, were not out there looking for trouble. Even the ones who were going up to the police and taunting them and shouting things at them were not looking for violence. I just don't think that this is a city full of angry, hateful people. And I actually feel better living in Brockton after what I saw.
Well, that's Boston Globe tech columnist and Boston Radio Boston regular Hiawatha Bray. Glad you're well, and thanks for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Oh, thank you.
So let's turn now to Boston last night. And again, join the conversation. Were you there? What did you see? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We have three guests for this conversation, all of whom we have spoken to in the last few days, and all of whom were there last night. First is one of the organizers of yesterday's protest, Monica Cannon Grant. She's the founder and CEO of the nonprofit Violence in Boston, which is focused on advocating for marginalized communities. Welcome back today, Monica.
Thank you for having me.
We also have Tito Jackson, former Boston City Councilor, Special Advisor to Parenting Journey, and Chief Executive of Verdant Medical. Tito, welcome back to you, too.
Thank you very much, but I work for Monica.
Fair enough. And Shigun Itawu. He's the Executive Director of the Black Economic Council of Massachusetts, co-founder of the Boston Police Camera Action Team. Welcome back to you as well.
I'm always happy to be anywhere that Monica and Tito are.
Excellent. So listen, I'm glad we have the three of you together. I'm going to start with some questions for Monica, because we had you on just before the protest yesterday, Monica. You told us you had 7,500 people registered. You thought you might get even more. Thousands turned out last night. How are you feeling today?
I feel overwhelmed. I feel grateful. I feel like we got our point across. And now the real work begins to fight for the pieces of legislation we discussed at the rally yesterday.
And what is that point that you feel like you got across last night?
I guess for me, it's people need to understand that protesting is a part of politics. And you can organize and pull people together, but you have to give them tangible things to walk away with to actually do. And that's what we did yesterday. We organized in such a way where we sent a clear message. And the message was is that, yes, we're angry. We're tired of police brutality. You're not going to continue to kill us and not be held accountable. But along with protesting, we're going to hold you accountable on a legislative level. And I think we accomplished those things in regards to plugging people in. But we sent a clear message that because the protest was held in a community that is predominantly people of color, you won't come and tear up our community.
So, Tito, you and Monica worked closely together on this, or according to you, you worked for Monica on this. How would you assess the march last night?
It was a great success. Again, I think, one, the fact that a Black woman led this along with Black Lives Matter is actually notable. I also believe that having all of those folks, supporters, allies, actually, I believe Monica calls them accomplices in this work, all come together and stand and say that Black Lives Matter, that Black bodies cannot continue to be destroyed. And Monica thoughtfully is working not only for folks to blow off steam, but actually has an agenda that is about making sure that Black bodies are protected. So I think that is absolutely critical. And it also shows that people can assemble in a peaceful manner in our own communities, and our voice and our First Amendment rights can be heard. So it was a great success, and I'm very proud of the work that Monica was able to pull together in our city, and I'm proud of Boston.
And Shigun, let me turn to you. You were there last night as an attendee. How do you think people were feeling out there last night as it was going on?
Well, you know, I've been to a number of protests here in Boston, which is not something to be happy about, because it's all been about the same topic. But I have to say that yesterday's gathering of people, a sea of people, was probably one of the most uplifting and affirming experiences I've ever felt at one of these protests. And so I have to give a lot of credit to Monica and her team. Not just Tito, but Black Lives Matter, Boston, and many of the others who work to make sure, you know, we don't always give credit or think about all the work that goes into making sure that folks are able to be there safely and, you know, all the mechanics that go into that. So, you know, a lot of kudos goes to the team that made that happen. But it was a phenomenal experience. But, you know, I already knew it was going to be because I've, you know, I have a lot of faith in the leadership of Monica and the rest of her team members. So it was a good experience for all of us.
Monica, I want to ask you one more question, then I'll turn to a call. You talked a minute ago about how part of the message you got across last night is that demonstration protest is part of the political process. As you think about that, explain what do you think is the right relationship between police and peaceful protesters, especially when the protest is specifically about the police themselves? What should that look like? And what should the orientation of police be in those moments?
So I am not in no position to tell someone how they should protest in regards to police brutality and their experience with police departments. What I will say is that I've learned in my years of doing this work that you protest, but you protest with a purpose. And so for me, yes, I'll be the protester to scream Black Lives Matter, no justice, no peace, but I'm also going to push you to do something. Tito, being a mentor of mine, taught me a long time ago is you never sit down at a table with someone who has the power to do something and walk away with nothing. And so my point was to hold space for my people and my community because we needed an outlet to deal with the PTSD, anger, and hurt that we're experiencing for having to be here again. But the other piece is to push those who we elect in office to do the things we need them to do, because a police officer should be held accountable in the same manner that a regular citizen is held accountable because he took an oath to take a job to protect and serve. And so that's the thought process in regards to that. But I will never be the person to tell anyone how to protest, mainly because protesting looks different for everyone.
I'd like to grab a call here, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK to join the conversation. We've got Robin on the line from Lowell. Robin, go ahead.
Hi, I was at the protest last night. I'm 62 years old. I did not like having to go out of my house and be present where COVID could be, but I felt I had to. And I think Hiawatha is trivializing people's going out because there is a need. We have to stop this violence.
I appreciate that, Robin. You know, Tito Jackson, yesterday we had Boston City Councilor Kim Janey on the air, and she talked in very strong terms about the fact that the same people who are being disproportionately affected by COVID-19 are now forced to go out and put themselves at risk to protest because of being disproportionately affected by police brutality and systemic racism. Robin's bringing that point back around. How are you thinking about that today?
Well, I'm one of those people who's disproportionately affected by COVID-19. I had it. I actually got up, Hiawatha, I don't agree with the perspective, that this was something that people were taking advantage of. People have a right to be angry, and they should be angry when folks who are on public payrolls are judged by different rules. And when we consistently see a small population, 13% of the United States population, disproportionately killed by law enforcement officials. That's unacceptable, hands down, and we need to make sure that we stand up and have our voices heard. Now, as Monica and Black Lives Matter and everybody out there last night, we were able to do this peacefully, but when it comes down to it, people's voice need to be heard. And I think people also need to realize in 2004, when the Red Sox won, what happened? And countless times throughout sporting events that I absolutely don't believe are on this level, you see things happen. What we were able to show last night is that people can come into our community, their voice can be heard, and we can get something done. And I think it is notable that Monica, the night before, had Elizabeth Warren, Congresswoman Ayanna Pressley, as well as Senator Kirsten Gillibrand, who were actually now signing on to three pieces of legislation that would prevent people from being shot in the back, a piece of legislation that requires officers not to choke folks out and kill them, as well as another piece of legislation that requires medical attention when they're asked. That's the Gardner bill, the Andrew Kearse bill, as well as the Stephon Clark bill. So this has an end, has a goal, and it's not only about what we're about blowing off steam. We have to be there to do this, and this is what democracy looks like.
I want to turn to another call and then come back to Monica and Shagun, but I do want to say, I just for the record, I felt like what I heard Hiawatha saying at the top was that the people who were out at night were people who were feeling getting out after COVID-19. I didn't hear him saying to Robin the caller that he thought people were protesting COVID-19, just to clarify there. I do want to grab one more call here, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We have Mary Ellen on the line from East Ham. Mary Ellen, go ahead.
Hi. I think that we should think about that the fact that the Defense Department has provided police all over the country with surplus military equipment. I think it's contributed to the formation of a not just a groupthink, but almost a military groupthink. And I've seen that in my own community when up the Cape when it was moved here. And I was shocked when the police department went from 3 to 9 over a period of 20 years, no claim change. But the way in which officers carried themselves was they were always wearing flak jackets, they were always carrying weapons, and this is a community or this is where murder, gun carrying, and so forth is not.
So, Mary Ellen, let me take it back from you there. Thank you for raising that. And I want to turn to Monica and Shagun and ask you, did you see a police presence in riot gear in more military style last night? And what was your reaction to that?
Well, so this is Shagun. I mean, I would say this kind of ties to your question to Monica earlier about the role of police at these protests for the reason that folks are gathering. I mean, my opinion is that I don't think police should be there at all. I think we've shown for the last three protests that have happened in the last 5 days that we are able to assemble peacefully. The problems always arise when the police have shown an unprovoked, show of force, where it antagonizes the crowd and folks respond in kind. And so, you know, to Mary Ellen's point, I mean, I definitely agree that, this gear can, helps to boost this mentality that that our police are at war. But to be honest with you, the police have always operated as another type of gang in our community And it's never really been about the gear, but just the mentality and the power that our policies give them. You know, Tito mentioned that they are public servants that operate with another set of rules. And so that alone gives this holier than thou and this powerful mentality that they can do and say whatever they want. This is something that we experienced yesterday after the protest. Monica was very clear at the end of the protest that everyone is going to turn around and go home. That if you do anything to tear up the Black community that you're in, that the Black community will not allow that to happen. And all of us were walking away peacefully, going back to our cars or other modes of transportation. And for some reason, the Boston Police Department decided to roll up on the crowd. And this is what antagonized the crowd yesterday. But if the officers had not been there, folks knew why we were there, why we were protesting, that it was supposed to be peaceful, and we would have left the same way. So really, it's about police presence overall, not just what they're wearing or the weapons that they have.
So, Monica, what was your reaction to that moment, and why do you think the police came in all of a sudden then?
So I don't know why. I'm not sure why the police came in, but as we watch what has happened across this country, oftentimes police departments have been in a position of prompting the violence, and they actually start the shoving and pushing. And then, you know, as children, we're told if somebody hits you, hit them back. And so when people respond, then it turns into something way bigger than what it's supposed to be. On yesterday, I'm not quite sure why they came through the crowd the way that they did. But what I will say is that for the most part, it was a peaceful event. There were a couple of tense moments where they came through the crowd and we weren't quite sure. And immediately we told them they had to go. And Tito Jackson played a role in that, letting them know, I don't know what your presence is here and what the hell is going on, but turn around and leave. And they obliged. I also want to say that throughout the whole time yesterday, I did see the police presence in the situation that the gun pointed out. But throughout the whole rally, I didn't see tanks and things like that were there. And I'm not sure if it was around the corner on a side street, because that very well could have been the case. But what I will say is that the community we held the rally in yesterday was our community. And I don't worry about what the police are doing. I don't worry about what elected officials are doing. But I live here and I raise my children here. I'm born and raised here. And so I ensured that we had security for my people, aside from whatever the police's agenda was or what their plan was, because it does not concern me. And I think what people need to understand is we're cool with the protesting. I'm not in the habit of dictating how anyone protests, because Martin Luther King said it best, a riot is the voice of the unheard. So yesterday, just so happened to be the anniversary of the Roxbury riots. And that happened, I think, in either 1967, 1968. And so it wasn't until we started protesting that movement happened. 5 days went by before an arrest was made in George Floyd's murder. And so when people started protesting and tearing up the streets, then action was taken. And so both things need to happen.
So I want to turn to Tito for a minute now. Tito, you stepped in last night with a bullhorn at a moment at the Boston Police headquarters when things got tense. You were trying to calm them down. There was some video of that. I want to play a little bit of the tape of what you said.
Yeah. I'm a 6'2", 270-pound Black man. I'm angry as hell. Yeah.
Right?
But when it comes down to it, these men and women back here don't set policy in the city of Boston. The people at City Hall set policy in the city of Boston.
Yes. Did the protesters around you hear you about the public policy argument you were making there, Tito?
Interesting place to give a public policy speech. I think they actually heard me more than the people in City Hall when I was there. When it comes down to, that conversation, I applaud people's use of their First Amendment rights. They have a right to be there. They have a right to speak out, and they listened. I had many deep conversations with young people around how things work, around budgets in the city. And Monica and I always talk, and actually Shigun too, a budget is a value statement. Where you put your money has to do with the values that we have. And so, we don't run out of money for the police department in the city of Boston. I also let them know that all of the police officers who were standing there were on overtime. And so, in fact, they the resources that we're talking about, more of them were going to the folks there because they because we were standing there. But it was an opportunity to connect with folks. I do want to note the police officers who were there, they took a knee with us in solidarity.
Yeah, what about that?
You know what? There was a superintendent there, a Black woman, who led. She stepped forward and she took a knee, and all of the other officers, I'm sorry, not all, all other than two officers took a knee. You know what? Maya Angelou said, when people tell you about themselves, believe them the first time. You know, and I spoke to some of the officers and I said, hey, you know, those are two individuals you guys need to think about when it comes to how they're interfacing and interacting with our community. But we did have that moment, and it was a very important moment. The young people there said, hey, if you guys take a knee, we'll leave, we'll go home. And there was this connection when we all took a knee together. And one of the other pieces that we need to deal with in Boston is we need more Black police officers in our city to be part of the Boston Police Department. And we need a recruitment, not only strategy, but we need to change the rules so Black police officers can get in. We also need to make sure that the work that Shagun was doing around every officer having a body cam, as well as the work that has been brought up about us having a civilian review board with teeth. We can't point fingers at other cities without looking at ourselves.
So we've got about a minute left, and I want to turn to Shagun and give you kind of last word here. Shagun, Tito said that he thought the protesters heard him more than people in City Hall did when he was a city councilor. You talked about fatigue at having to be out there protesting again. Is institutional change going to happen? Do you believe it can?
Well, because of the efforts of folks like Monica and Tito and Black Lives Matter Boston and many others, I'm absolutely confident that there's going to be institutional change that happens, because we're not going to let this particular moment slip us by. And so, you know, yes, we're tired of being out there, but, you know, the whole thing behind that, there's a lot of energy behind that to ensure that we don't ever have to be out there for this particular reason again. And so, you know, the goal is to make sure that not just City Hall in Boston, but that the other 350 cities and towns in Massachusetts hear this message loud and clear, because a Black person should feel free to go anywhere in the Commonwealth. And this exact message is also being brought to the State House to ensure that the 200 elected legislators there and the House and the Senate hear this message loud and clear, and that the governor himself hears this message, and that they are forced to do more than release a public statement saying that they hear us, but ensuring that they actually listen and follow through.
All right, I'm going to have to end us there. That's Shagun Idowu. He's the executive director at the Black Economic Council of Massachusetts. Thank you. Tito Jackson, former Boston City Councilor and special advisor to Parenting Journey, thanks so much for being with us. And Monica Cannon Grant, founder and CEO of the nonprofit Violence in Boston and organizer from last night. Thank you, too. I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston. We want to continue our conversation about the events from last night and issues of race and policing from a broader perspective. So joining us now to help us do that is Suffolk County Sheriff Stephen Tompkins. Sheriff Tompkins, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Oh, so glad to be back. Thank you for having me.
Appreciate you doing it. And I want to start by asking you about your reaction both to last night, to Sunday in Boston, and your overall impression of what's played out over the last few days.
Well, starting with Sunday, you know, the electeds of color had a little, I don't know if you call it a vigil. We stood outside of the State House yesterday and we made some comments and shared some thoughts. And one of the thoughts that I had was that although marching is a tenet, a strong tenet of protest, I said, look, why don't you have your protests in a park or a stadium during the day and have your message be heard so that when it's reported, the positives of the message are really what's conveyed. Once cover of darkness comes and you're marching through cities, and we saw with many cities in this country, bad things could potentially happen. And that is what happened when you have looting and rioting and the like. whether it's from folk that live in this state or folk from outside of this state. And so I'll juxtapose that to last night. They had a big rally in Franklin Park during daylight, and it went very well. Now, I will also say this. I know Monica Cannon and her folk, and they're really good at putting things together. And Monica does not suffer fools gladly. And so I would not have wanted to have been the person to step out of line with Monica, because she'll let you know about it. But I thought yesterday was a positive. I thought Sunday was a positive during the day, not so much at night.
Do you believe Sunday night that law enforcement responded appropriately?
In the city of Boston, for the most part, listen, organizations, security organizations, law enforcement organizations are built to be strong and viable. And in some instances, they can be a bit punitive. Now, I'm not going to say that's what happened in Boston, but you can only push so far and you're going to have a breaking point. I do not advocate violence, police violence or police brutality. And we did see a lot of that, unfortunately, in other cities. Not as much in Boston, which I'm glad to say. But that said, there needs to be an understanding on both sides of the equation with the people that are trying to get their message across and with the practitioners of security to understand that a people, i.e. people of color, black people particularly, that have been under siege for 400 years are very, very, very unhappy. And when you have a police officer that in essence murders a black male, suffocates him, causes a heart attack.
You're referring to Derek Chauvin in Minneapolis.
Yes, ma'am, I am. Mr. Floyd, when you see that and you see just how cavalier this officer was, he had his hands in his pockets as he was kneeling on this gentleman's neck. You know, I mean, that's just it. I mean, that's kind of our Rosa Parks moment, if you will, that people just have had it. The thing about these protests that I'm heartened by is the fact that there are black and white, young and mature. They're the physically handicapped, LGBT, every race, you name it. Every race is out. And so everybody's coming out to say, okay, this is enough. We will no longer stand for this. And unfortunately, we have a gentleman that's occupying the White House right now that really doesn't understand compassion and empathy and strife and heartache and pain. And
I want to pick it up right there for a second, Sheriff Tompkins. I'm sorry for interrupting you, but there is a question I want to ask you kind of in that vein. We know the president has used rhetoric around dominating and military presence control. As a law enforcement officer, what is, in this moment, the appropriate stance and approach of police at a moment of protest with protesters? Is it safety? Is it listening and understanding? Is it clearing the streets? What's the right orientation for law enforcement in those protests?
Well, it's all of the above. It is safety. It is understanding. And you have to have empathy. Whether it's black Americans or any group of people that are protesting, they didn't just wake up one day and say, hey, I'm just going to go protest. They're protesting for a reason. And so you have to understand, law enforcement has to understand what that reason is and be welcome to it because it's coming. On the flip side, the people that are protesting need to also understand that law enforcement is put there in place for public safety. And at the end of the day, that's what they're going to do. They are going to try to protect lives and property. And so you can only push that ball so far down the field before law enforcement is going to push back. And then that's where you have the conflict.
So any concern from you, Sheriff Tompkins, that the militarization of police, meaning equipment, over the last 20 years or so, has escalated the tension between law enforcement officers, protesters, communities?
It's not just the militarization of law enforcement that concerns me. It's the inability to understand that you're dealing with human beings and you're dealing with people's lives. And particularly when you couple that with a pandemic, people are on one side of the coin, they're suffering, they're hurt, and they're afraid. Now, I am not in favor of flagrant militarization of police force. I don't go there. But you have to understand where we're at when you're dealing with people, once again, that have been under siege for 400 years. Listen, African-Americans, Black Americans did not come to this country as immigrants looking to better their station in life. They didn't come to this country as indentured servants that may have the ability to buy their way out of servitude. They came as chattel. They came as property. Human beings came as property of other human beings. And listen, this country was built on the backs of those slaves. Now, Black Americans want to be loved as much as we love this country. We feel ownership and pride in this country, but then we get the short end of the stick. All that we've built to help build up this country, others have profited from that, and we haven't. And to think that that is going to be okay, well, it's not okay. And what's happening now is particularly time after time after time when Black men are being gunned down in the streets, you're going to get to a point where enough is enough. And people have arrived there. I think they were there a while ago, frankly.
So to that point, Sheriff Tompkins, in our last minute or so. Yeah, okay, go ahead.
I was going to just say, you know, in the age of having smartphones where everything can be recorded now, see, before, you didn't have the documentation of what was going on in the way that you do now. And so with that documentation, this shows the world just how out of control things have become. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off.
No, I didn't mean to cut you off either. To that last point, we have a minute left. What concrete actions should people in law enforcement officers, be taking right now towards a solution?
Well, right now, law enforcement really needs to come to grips, and I think we are, needs to come to grips with the fact that we cannot continue to populate our jails and prisons with as many Black and brown people, with as many immigrants and poor people, and there are a lot of poor white people. We need to understand that we are our brothers and sisters' keepers, and that we need to comport ourselves as such and work collaboratively and collegially with the people that we are paid to guard their safety and their property. And somewhere along the way, that's gotten out of control. And I'll wind up by saying this. The vast majority of law enforcement are fine and upstanding men and women that come to do the work that they're paid to do. And actually, a lot of us really love the work that we do. But when you have ignorance and arrogance and racism matched up with a system that in a lot of instances have been outrageously punitive, well, bad things are going to happen. And so that's where we're at now. So what we need now is kind of a timeout. We need a timeout. We need things to quiet down so that we can readjust, reevaluate. And I think our law enforcement, our justice system, not just law enforcement, really does need to have a cleansing, frankly. And we cannot.
Sheriff Tompkins, we're running out of time. I apologize. I'm going to have to stop you there. That's Suffolk County Sheriff Stephen Tompkins. I really appreciate your time today. Thank you. We're continuing our discussion about race and policing in America, the events of the last week, and how our community here in the Commonwealth is responding. We've heard this hour from people who attended protests last night and from Suffolk County Sheriff Stephen Tompkins just now on how he's thinking about issues of race and policing today. We want to now bring in some historical perspective. Joining us to do that is Khalil Gibran Muhammad. He's a professor of history, race, and public policy at the Harvard Kennedy School and author of The Condemnation of Blackness, Race, Crime, and the Making of Modern Urban America. Welcome back to Radio Boston, Khalil.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So let me just begin by asking you your reaction to how the nation is responding to what happened to George Floyd, especially in a larger context, and how are you responding personally?
Well, I think that generally speaking, we are seeing the largest demonstrations in a half a century with respect to systemic racism. It's not an accident that we'd have to go back to the late 1960s, which produced years and years worth of civil unrest and uprisings, eventually leading to the Kerner Commission report that documented in city after city systemic racism, institutional discrimination, and a whole lot of police violence. The irony, of course, is that the Kerner Commission report was more or less shelved by Johnson. He did not run for re-election in 68. Nixon won, and so began 4 decades of the war on crime and the war on drugs and mass incarceration. So here we are.
You know, one of the things that struck me in reading an op-ed that you put together last July, so almost a year ago, was the litany of reports over really the last 20 years, so quite recently, of unconstitutional policing behavior after investigations were done in cities across the country. It was a huge number of reports that found unconstitutional policing.
Yeah, so, you know, Americans have short memories and small appetites for these kinds of very candid displays of what racism looks like, in part because most Americans, particularly white Americans, have not had to wrestle with these issues in their daily lives, and we do a poor job in our K-12 school systems. But, you know, we've been having blue ribbon commissions of one kind or another, or DOJ consent decrees and pattern and practice investigations for a century. And, you know, we're talking about Detroit, New Orleans, Seattle, Cleveland, East Haven, New York, Albuquerque, Portland, Oregon, Baltimore, Los Angeles. I mean, I'm just naming city after city going back to the 1990s when the DOJ started to do such things, saying essentially the same thing, that we have a systemic problem of police bias on one end and outright constitutional violations of civil liberties on another.
Khalil, I know that we have listeners that have been hearing our coverage over the last week and feeling very frustrated that this sustained conversation about police brutality, about the way police in America treat Black Americans, is disrespectful, that it doesn't recognize the life and limb that police officers risk in doing their jobs, that it doesn't recognize that when somebody throws things at you, frozen water bottles, rocks, you're at risk and need to react. How do we put that piece of the concern in this larger context of the history of oppressive and unconstitutional behavior that we also know has played out, as you just said, in police departments around the country?
Well, first of all, I'd say that every citizen has the constitutional right to say what they think about the police in the presence of the police. They have a right to object to a police action. They don't have a right to resist arrest when the lawful arrest is being made, but they most certainly can question officers. What we're seeing on the streets in terms of the protests, the water bottles, that's not the context in which the problem of policing is playing out. That's just a reaction to the protest itself. So I would say that the vast majority of African Americans are experiencing and have been experiencing for 100 years a kind of everyday form of subtle aggression and physical abuse when it escalates to that point. I mean, the evidence on stop and frisk is just unimpeachable when it comes to 4.4 million people having been stopped just in one city alone, 90% of them Black or brown, less than 10% of them being issued even so much as the summons. And each one of those forms of contact could lead to the kind of sense that you don't belong in this society, that you don't have the right to come and go as you please. So the record is very clear that the kind of policing that police officers have been empowered to do, that has been lawful, that has been sanctioned by elected officials and other authorities, has been profoundly hurtful and discriminatory to the African-American community. And that some people will say that's anti-police is so fundamentally part of the problem. The privilege of expecting that other people will be subjected to the kinds of conditions that make you think that you don't belong is what systemic racism in America is all about. So I don't have a lot of patience for that kind of response. Also, policing is not a form of conscription. You're not drafted into policing. So if people think that they get to demand respect from a citizen, which is not what is required in policing, police officers do not have to be respected by the citizens of this country in order for them to do their jobs. It would be nice, And we spend a lot of time talking about trust and legitimacy, which I think are good things. But the notion that you actually can be lawfully beat down or embarrassed or have a dog sit put on you like was happening in Ferguson systematically because you have an attitude with the police is exactly the wrong problem to focus on.
So let's talk about reform for a minute, Khalil. You've talked on numerous, you've written in numerous instances about complaints, investigations into questionable practices in police departments that have gone unattended. More of the same has followed. We've seen something similar play out with the Minneapolis Police Department, where we know, for example, Officer Derek Chauvin had nearly 20 complaints against him. We've heard, I think you've been listening all hour, I think you heard Shigan Itawu at the beginning of the hour express frustration over protests over and over again and the systemic change not happening. What has to happen for police forces, systems of police, I'm not finding the right word that I want, but for individual police departments to begin to take on and enact those reforms? How do we get there?
Well, I'm sorry to say that all that history and all those reports and all the evidence suggests that you can't get there by asking police to do something that they're not capable of doing. Not going to happen. And, I mean, it's like suggesting that climate change is going to happen if we just figure out how to make cleaner coal. Not going to happen. You don't get there. So how do you get there? We have to decide that we want police officers to do less of what they do, to do less mental health care, to do less nuisance calls, to do less crime prevention where simply living in a high crime area makes you a suspect because the people who live around you in high crime areas, less high crime areas will feel safer. So that includes defunding the police. It includes positioning public resources in public budgets for community health initiatives, public health initiatives, community workers who already have proven track records, like Cure Violence Global, for example, which I admittedly I'm on the board of, but have proven track records of violence interruption and other forms of non-police community interventions.
We spoke with Michael Bradley earlier today, Upton, Massachusetts police chief, about whether there are specific concrete reforms he'd support to hold back actors accountable. I want to play a little bit of what he had to say for you.
We're always looking to hold our people accountable, you know, to discipline officers when it's appropriate. You know, I'm sure there is work that can be done through the unions, through arbitration. There may be some steps that can be taken there to improve the ability to remove police officers that are unfit to do the job.
In our last minute or so, if there are police departments and police officials like that ready to and willing to take the steps, what are the policy moves that need to be made at local and regional levels in order to create those conditions?
Well, he's absolutely right. The unions are a huge impediment to system change, agency change, department by department. Bad apples, when they are very clearly rotten, are reimposed or reinstituted on departments because of union or collective bargaining agreements. And if they do manage to get fired from one department, they move on to another because of protections of privacy between one department agency and another, or certainly protections with the public. So we need much stronger collective bargaining agreements that shift a lot of power away from unions to protect officers regardless of their behavior and how their values may not align with the organization. It's also true that we need far more independent scrutiny. The call for civilian review boards has been going back to the 1920s. It hasn't happened, and the reason it hasn't happened because it is a strong mechanism for holding police officers accountable to public standards. So it's not, again, if we're going to expect them to change themselves, then we, the public, and the elected officials who represent us are going to have to do the hard work of making those changes.
And that is Khalil Gibran Muhammad, professor of history, race, and public policy at the Harvard Kennedy School, and author of The Condemnation of Blackness, Race, Crime, and the Making of Modern Urban America. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
And that's our show for today. Radio Boston is produced by Jamie Bologna, Zoe Mitchell, Chris Siderick, Paris Alston, and Walter Wuthman. Tim Skog is our technical director, with engineering today by Jimmy Kiesling. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi. I'm Tiziana Deering. Thanks for listening, and I hope you'll join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.